Look, it's Monday, April 27th. We're tracking a massive week for tech earnings that'll either prove the AI hype is real or show us the receipts aren't there yet. Following up on the Middle East tensions we've been tracking, the markets are currently playing a very dangerous game of ignore the volatility. Plus, we've got some grim news for the Kentucky Derby favorite. Let's get into it. The markets are currently operating in a bit of a parallel universe. Despite ongoing regional instability in the Middle East and the potential for supply chain disruptions, investors have largely decided to look the other way, pushing stocks higher based on tech and services earnings. It's a striking disconnect from geopolitical reality. According to reports, this resilience is being fueled by a belief that we've moved past a fossil fuel-dependent economy, meaning a mess in the region doesn't rattle the cage like it used to. Instead, the market has become a dip-buying machine, driven by demographic growth and AI innovation. Here's the thing. This detachment is a massive gamble. The market is essentially betting that its own lack of concern is the same thing as a resolution to these tensions. It's not. There's a very real risk of a future reckoning once the sustained impact of high energy prices actually hits the books. Right now, investors seem to think being close to AI development, like we see in the tech sectors of Israel and Taiwan, matters more than energy security. It's a bold strategy, but it smells like overconfidence. If the regional friction drags on into 2027 as some expect, the Federal Reserve isn't going to have the cover to cut interest rates. The Musk magic might keep people buying the dip for now, but ignoring a conflict because you're excited about a chatbot feels like a recipe for a shitty Tuesday down the road. Speaking of big tech, we're seeing a changing of the guard among the industry's most iconic leaders. Following a series of reports on long-term CEO performance, Tim Cook at Apple and Doug McMillon at Walmart are being held up as the gold standard for successions. Cook, specifically, has nearly quadrupled Apple's revenue and market cap by mastering the unsexy stuff, supply chain logistics. He managed to keep the iPhone's high margins while scaling to mass production, all while pivoting the company towards services and wearables. But even with those numbers, the legacy is complicated. Critics point to a lack of one more thing, groundbreaking products, and some questionable public maneuvering with Donald Trump. Still, the takeaway for the C-suite right now is that operational excellence and empathy, actually tying individual success to the company's wins, are what's keeping these ships afloat. It's less about being a visionary genius and more about holding teams accountable with clear metrics, which honestly sounds a lot more sustainable than the alternative. However, if you look at the private markets, things get a lot murkier. There is a growing transparency crisis involving the big three of the private tech world: SpaceX, OpenAI, and Anthropic. There's been a lot of chatter about SpaceX's internal valuation reaching $180 billion. But according to reports, some of these private marks are essentially bullshit numbers based on future stock-based compensation rather than actual cash. It's part of a broader trend where these massive companies are operating with the financial reporting standards of a garage startup. They're burning through mountains of cash with no clear revenue streams, yet they're being valued as if they're already S&P 500 stalwarts. This is a systemic risk. When SpaceX or Anthropic finally go public, they'll be forced to actually show their homework. If the reality doesn't match the hype, we're looking at a significant market correction. OpenAI's IPO is already looking uncertain because their financial numbers are frankly stark. We might even see a massive shift where investors dump Tesla stock to chase the Musk magic over at SpaceX. It's all fun and games until the IPO prospectus hits the desk and everyone realizes the emperor is wearing very expensive, very opaque clothes. Finally, there is a quiet crisis brewing in American homes that's being ignored by the headlines: the rise of the club sandwich generation. This discussion is gaining steam as new labor data shows a spike in people, mostly women, who are stuck caring for their kids, their aging parents, and often their grandchildren all at once. It's an unsustainable level of burnout, caused by a total collapse of social support. The facts are pretty grim. Rising childcare costs and a lack of long-term care infrastructure are forcing families to create these mini-care economies entirely on their own. We're seeing reports of caregivers facing bankruptcy because they're absorbing the escalating costs of elder care as public funding like Medicaid gets squeezed. There's this idea of the individualization of risk. The government treats health and elder care as a personal problem rather than a public good. This leads to what's being called secondhand stress. Caregivers are absorbing the anxiety of everyone they're looking after, thinning their own emotional membranes until there's nothing left. It's a shitty situation, honestly. We're expecting grandparents to provide free childcare because parents can't afford it, while those same grandparents need specialized care themselves. This isn't something people can self-care their way out of with a bubble bath or a support group. Until we recognize caregiving as a collective responsibility, with actual policy for paid leave and affordable housing, the sandwich is just going to keep getting crushed. So, while the economy tries to ignore the geopolitical sandwich it's in, the tech world is preparing for a reckoning. The tech sector is staring down a massive week of earnings that could finally answer the multi-billion dollar question: when does all this AI spending actually turn into profit? According to reports from the markets, five of the Magnificent Seven, Apple, Microsoft, Meta, Amazon, and Alphabet, are all reporting this week. For Microsoft and Amazon, investors are looking specifically at whether the massive capital expenditures on data centers and custom silicon are showing up as revenue growth. They have to prove that AI won't cannibalize their core search business before they figured out how to make money on the new stuff. It's essentially a high-stakes moment of show me the receipts. We've spent 18 months hearing about how this changes everything, but the stock market is starting to get a little impatient with the trust us, it's coming narrative. This pressure to monetize is actually driving a lot of the hype we see. Morgan Housel notes that because AI hardware has a brutal shelf life of only 12 to 24 months, companies are forced into a cycle of continuous, massive investment. To get the capital to keep up, they have to make increasingly hyperbolic claims about what the tech can do. It's a bit of a cycle. You need the money to buy the chips, so you promise the moon, which makes the chips obsolete faster, so you need more money. But while the C-suite is focused on the balance sheet, the actual technology is creating some messy security headaches. Anthropic's Claude 2 model is being discussed in a new light, as they've restricted it to a few partners like Amazon and Microsoft, because the model is a double-edged sword. As reported, Claude 2 is incredibly good at finding software bugs, which is great for defense, but it's also capable of generating exploits to attack those same bugs. Anthropic is worried about a vulnerability window where the AI finds more holes than humans can patch, leaving systems wide open. To make matters worse, there are reports of unauthorized access to Claude 2 through a third-party vendor. This is the part of the existential risk narrative that feels less like sci-fi and more like a shitty day at the office. We're building tools that are better at breaking things than we are at fixing them. And then we're losing the keys to the cabinet. On the economic side, there's a growing debate about what happens to the rest of us once these models are everywhere. One school of thought suggests we aren't headed for mass unemployment, but rather a relational economy. The idea is that as AI commodifies basic tasks, human labor will shift toward things that require provenance and personal connection. Think healthcare, teaching, or high-end hospitality, where the human touch is the actual product. Morgan Housel, however, is a bit more skeptical about the standard solutions being floated for the transition, specifically universal basic income. He argues that the problem isn't just money, it's that paying people to be idle leads to societal breakdown and mental health crises. He suggests that the messiness of human experience is actually our greatest defense against being replaced. AI can write a technically perfect book or host a fluent podcast, but it lacks the lived experience that makes people actually care. Which honestly is a nice thought, but being messy isn't exactly a line item on a resume that pays the rent. Finally, we're seeing AI get tangled up in the high-stakes world of the Federal Reserve. Senator Tom Tillis has cleared the way for Kevin Warsh to potentially lead the Fed after a federal probe into current chair Jay Powell was dropped. This matters for AI because central banks are moving away from simple inflation forecasts and towards scenario planning to deal with the volatility that both AI and geopolitical conflicts are injecting into the markets. The underlying theme here is that the creators of AI are being uncharacteristically honest about the risks. Unlike Henry Ford, who didn't see suburbs coming, or the early internet pioneers, who didn't predict social media's impact on democracy, AI developers are screaming about the dangers from the jump. They're telling us the house might burn down, while simultaneously asking for more matches and another $1 billion in funding. It's a hell of a way to run a revolution. Speaking of things that are high stakes and potentially a total mess, let's look at the track. The post positions for the 152nd Kentucky Derby are set, and the favorite Renegade just got handed a massive headache. He drew the rail. Post position 1. According to the latest reports, this is basically the basement of the starting gate. No horse has won the Derby from the rail since 2010. Even with the newer, redesigned gates, the historical data is pretty brutal. Look, if you're the favorite, the last thing you want is to be pinned against the fence with 19 other horses trying to dive bomb you going into the first turn. It's a shitty draw that forces Renegade's team to completely rethink how they're going to navigate the first quarter mile. Further out in the gate, the news isn't much better for 6 Speed. He drew post 17, which currently holds a 0% win rate in the history of the race. His trainer, Bhupat Simar, is trying to spin it as a win, saying it keeps him outside the early speed, but the history books don't care about your optimism. On the other end of the spectrum, Full Effort drew the far outside at post 20. Normally that's a death sentence, but as the reporting notes, recent winners have actually been coming from the wider gates. It gives the jockey room to move, which is better than being suffocated on the rail. In the middle of the pack, Potente and Wonder Dean landed in what's being called the options area. Potente took post 14, and Wonder Dean took post 10. These spots give the jockeys some tactical flexibility. They can see how the pace develops before deciding whether to commit to the lead or sit back. It's the safe, boring middle ground that actually wins races. While the trainers are stressing about the gate, the betting world is shifting its focus to contest play, specifically the qualifiers on twinspires.com. The strategy being reported right now isn't about picking the fastest horse, it's about bankroll survival. For the upcoming races at Churchill Downs and Oaklawn, the move is to Dutch your bets. This is where you split your money across win bets and backup exactas so you get the same payout regardless of which of your picks hits. The idea is to stop swinging for the fences and start focusing on show bets to meet the contest minimums. Churchill is looking particularly volatile right now with a lot of cheap claimers and unpredictable track conditions. The reporting suggests that the smart money is actually sitting on its hands during these messy races, using show bets to keep the bankroll alive until a more predictable race comes along. It's not flashy, and honestly, it's a bit of a grind, but in a 20-horse field like the Derby, sometimes the winner is just the person who didn't go broke by the fifth race. It's a cynical way to look at the sport of kings, but when the favorite is stuck on the rail and the track is a mess, cynicism is usually your best hedge. If the Derby is about surviving the rail, the NFL draft was about building a wall. The NFL draft just wrapped up, and the data shows a league effectively obsessed with the trenches. Teams in the middle of the first round, specifically picks 12 through 21, poured massive capital into offensive linemen to protect their quarterbacks. These aren't necessarily win-now picks. The reporting indicates teams are prioritizing long-term stability and pocket protection over immediate impact. Look, it's the classic boring but important strategy. You don't sell many jerseys with a right tackle, but you also don't get your $200 million quarterback's leg snapped in week 4 if the line actually holds. It's a calculated hedge against the injury risk that can tank a franchise's entire valuation in a single play. The draft also showed how best player available can override actual roster needs. According to the reports, this creates a cascading effect. Better protection leads to consistent offense, but it also creates a logjam where talented players end up underutilized or forced into internal competition. Switching gears to the business of scale, Garnet Station Partners is currently executing a buy-and-build strategy that's worth watching. Co-founders Alex Sloan and Matt Perelman are targeting what they call lighthouse businesses. founder-led companies in fragmented markets with 20% plus margins. They aren't looking for tech disruptors. They're looking for things like Burger King franchises and stable, core economy companies that have survived multiple cycles. The strategy here is about diluting micro-market risk. By rolling up these smaller entities into a consolidated platform, they can institutionalize them with better tech and management. It's a move away from the high-leverage, strip-it-for-parts private equity model and toward operational excellence. If you own one franchise, a local construction project can kill your foot traffic and ruin you. If you own 50, that's just a rounding error. It's a disciplined, somewhat dry way to build a massive platform. But in this economy, boring and durable is the new high growth. Finally, a note on the draft's secondary economy, the betting markets. We saw massive volatility in real time as rumors hit the floor. It's a reminder that the draft isn't just a talent pipeline anymore. It's a live, high-stakes trading floor where the insider information is often just noise until the card is actually turned in. All right, let's step away from the business of sports and look at the actual biology of how we function. Researchers are reporting that 7 days of intensive meditation can trigger a biological response that produces natural pain-relieving chemicals. According to one study, participants began manufacturing their own endogenous opioids at rates significantly higher than the efficacy typically seen in drug trials. The same researchers claim that blood plasma from these advanced meditators inhibited cancer cell multiplication in a majority of cases in a lab setting. Look, I'm usually the first person to roll my eyes at mind over matter talk. But if these claims hold up, the pharmaceutical industry should probably be sweating a little. It's still early stage research, but it's a hell of a data point. Stacy Sims is pushing back against the one-size-fits-all approach to health, arguing that most conventional advice is based on male physiology and is actually detrimental to women. Specifically, she notes that intermittent fasting can disrupt women's hormonal balance and circadian rhythms, leading to increased stress and weight retention. Instead, Sims recommends that women, especially those in perimenopause, swap long aerobic routines for a mix of heavy strength training and true high-intensity interval training to maintain bone density and metabolic control. It's the women are not small men argument, which honestly, it's wild we still have to say out loud in a medical context. But the takeaway is clear. Stop treating your body like a lab rat for protocols designed for guys in their 20s. Finally, a new framework for productivity suggests we should stop focusing on hacks and instead prioritize aggressive specificity. The argument is that true productivity isn't about efficiency, but about carving out protected time for deep work to prevent others from filling your schedule with their priorities. If you don't define your goals and commit to them publicly, you're just efficiently moving towards someone else's finish line, which is a pretty shitty way to spend a Tuesday. If you're managing a team in Fantasy Premier League, you're currently dealing with a different kind of productivity bottleneck. The lead story in Fantasy Premier League this morning is a massive scheduling bottleneck that's forcing managers into a game of chicken with the Premier League office. We are heading into game week 35, and the big tactical move right now is actually doing nothing. The league still hasn't officially confirmed the double game week allocations for Manchester City, Crystal Palace, and Bournemouth. Right now, there is a 75% probability that City and Palace will double in game week 36. But there's a 25% chance the schedule splits, which would see Bournemouth and City doubling in 36, while Palace and City double in 37. This isn't just trivia. It changes everything about how you spend your transfers this week. If you're looking at bringing back Gabriel, for instance, that decision is effectively on ice until we see if Bournemouth has a double or not. If they don't, a move like Saliba to Gabriel becomes a lot more attractive. The consensus across the board is to burn a transfer or wait until the absolute last second before the deadline to see if the league drops the official calendar. Making a move now is basically guessing, and in a season this tight, guessing is a great way to tank your rank. Speaking of rank, we're seeing a shift in how the elite managers are playing the closing stretch. One manager reported a massive slide from the top 200k to over 500k after a failed free hit in game week 34. They gambled on Everton defenders and skipped highly owned guys like Jared Bowen. It didn't go well. The takeaway here is that the differential play, taking a swing on a low ownership player to catch up, is getting harder because the field is getting smarter. High-risk strategies are being punished more severely than in previous years. On the player front, Cole Palmer and Joao Pedro are back from injury and expected to start. But there's a real debate about whether they're actually worth holding. Their upcoming fixtures are brutal, and for a player like Palmer, the frustration of owning him through Chelsea's volatility is starting to outweigh the points. Meanwhile, everyone is looking at Arsenal, with their title charge in full swing. The move is to load up on Gabriel, Raya, Saka, or Rice. If you don't have three Arsenal players yet, that's your priority. Though again, the defensive picks are currently stalled by the fixture uncertainty. Finally, let's talk about the on-the-beach narrative. You'll hear people say certain teams have checked out because they can't be relegated or win the league. The word is, ignore it. It's mostly a myth managers use to justify transfers they already wanted to make. Most of these teams are still playing for merit money and contracts. Don't dump a good player just because their team is sitting in 10th place with nothing to do on a Saturday. The play for Game Week 35 is strategic patience. If you've still got your wild card or bench boost, the timing is everything. Some are eyeing a wild card now, but holding it until Game Week 36 might actually set up a stronger bench boost for 37. It's a boring way to play, but right now, waiting for the data to actually exist is the only move that makes sense. Before we wrap up, here are a few other things to keep on your radar. Browsers are finally adding native lazy loading for video and audio. This means the site won't actually fetch those heavy files until you scroll down to them. It's a simple fix that should make the mobile web feel significantly less like it's dragging a bag of bricks. There's some new data on tax aversion, showing that people are basically sabotaging their own wealth just to spite the IRS. We get so obsessed with avoiding a tax bill today that we miss out on massive long-term compounding, which honestly is a pretty expensive way to say fuck you to the government. The private credit market is exploding because banks aren't allowed to lend to risky, over-leveraged companies anymore. So now, all that debt is just moving into the shadows where there's less regulation and even less transparency. We're essentially rebuilding the same fragile house of cards, just with a different logo on the door. And if you're looking at pet insurance, the math usually doesn't check out. Statistically, you're almost always going to pay more in premiums than you'll ever get back in claims. You're better off just putting that monthly payment into a high-yield savings account and praying your dog doesn't eat a literal rock. That's the board for Monday morning. Watch those tech earnings. It's going to be a loud week.